Hello, friends, and thank you for tuning into the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. A big hello to train conductors who are listening to this podcast right now as you go riding past the backyards of homes and churches and factories all across America, playing your harmonica, whistling Simon and Garfunkel songs as you look through your binoculars into the windows of suburban neighborhood homes and watch middle-aged people desperately fuck in an attempt to summon love into their relationships because they've forgotten that the real way to experience love in a failed relationship is to reconnect with novelty. Blow your train whistle at them. See if you can make them wake up to the fact that no matter how many times they slap their meat bodies against each other, it will bring no true happiness unless they have found a way to be Korean, which is the secret of really fixing your relationship, is just become Korean. Hello to all of you who are working in hospitals, delivering babies, to all of you who are making babies, and to all of you who have just had babies removed from inside your vaginas. I hope that you are extraordinarily happy here as we enter into the fall, which is my favorite time of year, and I'm really excited about the horrific and evil conditions of Los Angeles transforming into the wet, rainy season that comes at the end of the summer. Because LA has been a snarling, feverish cunt. And the last few weeks and months in LA have been atrociously hot and unforgivable. If I could, I'd punch the sun in the nose for this heat. It's been terrible. But I'm not in the heat right now. I'm in North Carolina. We did some shows. Joe Rogan and I did shows in Asheville and Raleigh. And because my parents are located in Western North Carolina, in the Asheville area, I decided to stay over. And I do not let my mom come to my comedy shows. Which, after people see my comedy shows, they seem to understand. But before that, they think I'm an asshole. But I would get in my head. It would be too much. It's too much to deal with. So I was very close to my mom's house performing stand-up comedy. And I decided I told her she couldn't come to the show, but I surprised her. And it was really weird because I hid in the basement. My stepdad and I planned this whole weird thing out where he took her to breakfast and then I hid in the basement. What I wanted to do was I wanted to go out into the woods and pretend I was a corpse and then have him come running up to the house and say, "Oh my God, there's a dead body in the forest. Come look at the dead body." and then she would come down into the woods and I would like, "Ah, Mom, I'm not dead. I'm not a corpse on your property. I'm your son." But rather than do that, just because it had been raining and I don't know, I think I got lazy. I hid in the basement and she was in the living room on the phone. And then there's a piano down here and I played some chords on the piano. Nothing. No reaction. She just totally ignored the fact that the piano in the basement had started playing by itself. And so then I snuck upstairs and she was on the phone in the living room and couldn't see me. And I rolled change there into the living room. And so she came walking around and I was in the laundry room and she came around the corner and looked right at me and didn't see me because it didn't fit into her paradigm that I would be in the house. And so then she went back around the corner and that was kind of shocking to stand there and see someone looking right at you who doesn't see you. It was really weird. And then I went around the corner and was like, "Mom." And then she saw me and it was really sweet and she kind of freaked out and it was awesome. But her explanation for how she managed to not see me by looking at me was she thought she was hallucinating. And that's, she just wrote it off like, "Oh, I just must be hallucinating my son. Back to my phone call." But I do that stuff all the time. So the next time you're hallucinating, make sure that when you think you're hallucinating a demon, that you're not actually seeing a demon. Don't write off abnormality as hallucination, because sometimes the novelty beams of the universe manifest in your life in a way that you absolutely can't expect. And your instinct to transform what you're seeing into a hallucination or to believe that there's absolutely no way some awesome thing could be happening to you can sometimes cause you to miss out on the entire experience. In this case, of course, I'm not going to pack my bags and be like, well, fuck you. You didn't see me in the laundry room. I'm out of here. But sometimes when love comes into your life, you can actually reject the love because you think that there's no way it could really be happening. And you become suspicious, or you become skeptical, or you think that you just can't, it doesn't fit into your idea of how life works. And so you tune it out and don't even see it at all to try to stay at whatever your median normal state is. This is the thing they talk about where the natives, when the ships came in, when Christopher Columbus sailed in for the first time, I don't know what islands, the Fiji Islands or wherever, they didn't see the ships, even though the ships were just floating there on the water, because their minds couldn't wrap around the fact that those ships could be there. But they were there. And then when the ships finally managed to reach the beach, they had to recognize that the ships were ill, because all the filthy Europeans living on the ships immediately started raping them and chopping them to bits. But there are positive versions of novelty. And it's amazing that right now at this very moment, you may be surrounded by incredible beings, entities, and ideas that you are not allowing yourself to experience just because they don't fit into your notion of how reality is. So open that third eye, embrace the spirit world, embrace the potential that this very day or this very week, novelty in the most incredible way can come exploding into your reality and can cause massive transformations in your life and your perception of the world. The Duncan Trussell Family Hour is sponsored by Shore Design T-Shirts. Shore Design T-Shirts is a company located in Thailand that not only creates the T-shirts that we sell at DuncanTrussell.com, but they have a wide selection of really cool T-shirts with a lot of amazing designs. My friend Bennett runs the company, and I highly recommend that you go to ShoreDesignT-Shirts.com. And if you put my name in when you buy some of their awesome stuff, hoodies, yoga wear, you will get 10% off. So go to shirtdesignt-shirts.com and check them out because they support this podcast. We are also sponsored by Audible. And you can go to audibletrial.com/family hour. And you will get a free audiobook if you sign up for a trial membership. And Audible will give to the podcast $15. So that's a way for you to get an awesome audiobook. And they're amazing books there. I think they even have DMT, the spirit molecule, on audiobook there. So if you want to listen to a book about how your pineal gland is actually exactly like the pockets of a drug dealer at Burning Man because it's filled with DMT, then you can get that audiobook for free just for signing up for a trial membership. And then if you don't want to continue to get audiobooks every month, you can cancel. But why wouldn't you want to get audiobooks? Not wanting to get audiobooks every month would be like having a beautiful unicorn that occasionally came in front of your house and blasted silver balls out of its asshole. Why would you want to run the unicorn off of your property and not get those sweet, glorious silver balls that you could stare into and know your own future? As that's what everyone knows is one of the many magical qualities of unicorn turds. So, audibletrial.com/family hour. Check out the podcast. Check out the audiobook, rather. Jesus, I'm sorry. I'm at my mom's house right now, and I'm staring out on the patio, and there's a legion of chipmunks that keep running by. And if you've never, chipmunks have to be the cutest thing on the planet. So it's really hard for me to think about anything more than the fact that there's tiny, beautiful little forest mice that really do look as though they could sing to you and really do seem like at any moment they might start tap dancing. They are adorable little things. Another way to support the podcast, if you want to support this podcast, is if you're thinking about making a purchase on Amazon. We've got an Amazon portal, which is located at DuncanTrussell.com. And if you click on our Amazon portal, then we get a percentage of anything that you buy. So if you are already shopping on Amazon, you want to support this podcast, go through that portal and bookmark that portal. And anytime you buy something on Amazon, you'll be donating to this podcast, which is awesome. finally, you can, a great way to support this podcast, if you don't feel like giving us green energy, is join the forum at duncantrussell.com and share your ideas and experiences with us. There's a really strong community of super cool people there, and I would love for you to be a part of it. A big thank you to all of you who have donated to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. A big thank you to all of you who have sent awesome stuff to my P.O. box. And a big thank you to all of you who have bought stuff from the shop. We're about to get the shop filled up again with new posters and new t-shirts. Sorry that everything's sold out, but we are in the process of putting orders in. So within the next few weeks, we'll have stuff there. And if this is any time past October 2012, go to the shop because there's going to be awesome brand new t-shirts covered in weird occult symbols that were designed by people from the forum. So go there and check it out. And finally, if you want to come see my meat body yap about stuff on stage, I'm going to be at the Comedy Mix in Vancouver this weekend coming up. It's the first weekend in October, and then after that, I'm going to be at Zany's in Chicago. So go to my website, check out my dates, come see me live. Now, everyone, as far as I'm concerned, the next guest is one half of the most important team of people in the universe. It's my mom. She created me along with my dad, and she is a brilliant a really brilliant spiritualist. She was a psychologist for many, many, many years. And she is the reason that I ended up getting into all the crazy spiritual stuff that I'm into now, because she always had an array of the deepest, weirdest books around when I was growing up. And that's the stuff that I started reading. So everyone, I would love for you to welcome into your earbuds the presence of my amazing mother. Please send out your psychic tendrils to embrace her wherever she may be. And welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour, my mom. Welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour, my creator, or half of my creator, my sweet mom. Hi, Mom.
Hi, Duncan.
What's it like having me as a son?
It is a joy having you as a son.
You, how old was I when you had me?
You were 5 weeks early.
Yes. Yep. What's the story? Can you tell the story of my birth?
Absolutely.
And then we'll get around to you.
Sure, absolutely. Well, you were 5 weeks early. It was full moon, of course. And we had gone to the swimming pool and had spent the day at the swimming pool.
This is the Sea Island Country Club.
This is the Sea Island pool.
It's a beach club.
Beach club.
It was like the beach equivalent of the country club.
Yes.
Because your mom was rich.
Not just my mom.
But your family.
My family had enough money to be comfortable.
You don't have to tiptoe around anything here.
They weren't really rich. They acted like they were rich.
But they did own a bunch of property in Georgia.
They owned property. They did not.
They owned
they
the
had
property.
A lot of property.
Didn't they own the property that they currently have those Illuminati meetings at? Like, what's the name of the island where the people who they protest, those people, and every once in a while they come and they film on Sea Island? You know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't know what you're talking
sure
about.
Sure you do. Not film, but you know, what's it called? The hippies protest these sons of bitches all the time, and they have their meetings in Sea Island. Hold on, I have to pause this. I'll tell you right now.
The G5?
The G5, that's it. Now you remember.
Okay. I didn't know what you were talking about. I don't know about the hippies protesting it. And I don't know about the Illuminati people. These are the Illuminati people.
The G5.
Okay, G5. That's Sea Island. And yes, my grandfather sold Sea Island for $20,000. $20,000.
Which is a lot back then.
To Howard Coffin, who's...
That's a sad name.
Well, it is, but he had a happy ending. And his...
What was his ending?
Well, Sea Island was his ending. I mean, he owned, I think, probably one of the tobacco companies, and he had Sapelo. He owned Sapelo, and his son is the person that started the Sea Island company.
And he sold Sea Island for 20 G's.
My grandfather did, yes. Your great-grandfather did.
Great-grandfather.
Your great-grandfather.
Why do you need the dough?
Well, he was into buying properties all over Georgia.
Right.
And that was one of the properties that he owned.
Now, how much do you think that is worth, Sea Island?
Well, I can't even imagine. It would be worth many millions of dollars. But then so would Little Cumberland.
Right. But the point is, your family had enough dough that you were able to go to a beach club and hang out when you were pregnant.
I was. That is true. I was. And I did hang out at the beach club when I was pregnant. And on the day of your birth, April 20th.
Yes.
We were splashing around in the pool with your older brother, and it became obvious to me that it was time to go to the hospital instead of hanging out in the baby pool.
Right.
Unless I wanted to have a baby in the baby pool.
Right.
Which I didn't. So we went to the hospital, and you proceeded to be born as quickly as you possibly could.
I had to get out.
Obviously, you did. You had things to do.
And then I popped out of you.
Yes.
And then what happened?
Well, I mean,
what'd you do? Did you look at me, or how does that work when you have a baby?
Well, you know, I don't want to get too personal here, Duncan.
You can. They know everything
Is
about
that right?
me.
Okay. Yeah. Do they know this? Do they know that you actually came into the world peeing on the doctor's glasses?
I haven't mentioned that one. Yeah, I don't remember it.
Well, that's the first thing that happened, is you came into the world like you had saved it up for 9 months, perhaps.
I still have to pee all the time.
Well, this was into the doctor's glasses.
So I piss in the doctor's glasses.
And I watch you do this.
When do they snip me?
After that.
So right after I pee in the doctor's face, he cuts off the tip of my cock.
Well, that, oh, I thought you meant snipping the umbilical. The next thing was
forget the umbilical. When did they do the circumcision?
That was like 2 minutes later, I'm sorry to tell you, and you did cry. You did.
Of course.
You screamed.
Of course you would.
I felt terrible. I thought it was a bad idea.
So this is the process of an American baby. American baby gets blasted out of the pussy, sprays in the doctor's face, and then gets the tip of his penis cut off.
And then.
No wonder we're all nuts.
Well, no. That's not the end of the story on that one. Then they wrapped you in a pink blanket because they didn't have any blue ones.
Humiliate him. Snip off the tip of his penis and wrap him in a pink blanket. It's like some evil initiation into a terrible fraternity.
Well, it was pretty funny. Actually, it was a funny start, all except the circumcision, which I think was a bad idea. I would never circumcise another child.
How do you run out of pink blankets?
You mean blue blankets.
Or blue blankets. It's your job.
I guess they had a run on blue babies that night.
I see.
I don't know.
So what's Dad doing during this?
He, at that particular time in history, fathers were not allowed in the delivery room.
Really?
Or in the labor area. So your father was out probably doing whatever he might have been doing.
Smoking.
Perhaps.
But he was in the hospital.
He was in the hospital. Yes, he was.
I mean, you make it sound, what you just said made it seem so ominous. Like he was like
in the alley
mugging people or something.
No, he was probably talking to your grandmother, my mother.
Right. So the family was there.
My mother, at least my mother and your father were there. I don't know who else was there.
So when did they let him in?
After you were born. In fact, I can remember now that I was able to talk on some kind of intercom system to them and warn them that a pink blanketed baby was coming out, but not to think that meant it was a girl. It was a boy.
Right.
So I didn't want them to think for 1 minute that you were anything other than what you were.
Right.
Which was my son.
Right. A boy. Two boys. You'd had two boys now. Where was Jeff at this time?
He must have been staying. I don't know, because my mother was at the hospital.
Jeff's my brother, P.S.
He must have been staying with either my sister or my father.
And he was three at the time.
He was three.
Was he aware that a baby was coming? Does a three-year-old understand that?
He did not have a context for understanding baby brother. He didn't. He had no context for that. So he was distressed upon your arrival home.
Right.
And he wasn't allowed in the hospital to see you because little kids weren't.
So this is just a primitive birthing ritual that is a product of some kind of horrible Southern formality or some kind of ridiculous, because now people just give birth into baby pools, or they give birth into like dolphins.
Well, I was in the baby pool and had to leave the baby pool.
Right. Because that's now, if it was now, what would have happened is there would have been a dolphin in the baby pool. Have you seen the dolphin water births?
No.
So people launch babies out underwater and then a dolphin comes up and like prods the baby, and then they bring the baby out and throw rose petals on it. And then that's like how people give birth now.
Well, we almost had that. We could have had that, you know, if we'd waited there instead of going to the hospital. No dolphins.
Well, you just didn't know back then.
We didn't.
I mean, that things were so formal back then.
They were very formal, and fathers were not allowed in labor and delivery.
How many, as you were walking out of the beach club to go to the hospital because you were in labor, how many black people did you pass?
Several.
Really?
Yes.
They were allowed there at that time?
Emma Murphy. Emma worked there, remember Emma?
So the employees.
Don't you remember Emma?
But there were no black people who were there as members.
No, black people were not allowed there. And I am not sure if in 1974, if Jews were allowed there.
But my grandfather was Jewish.
But no, he had converted to Christianity.
But he was
Semitic. He was a Jew that converted to Christianity in the, maybe the 20s.
So because he'd converted to Christianity, he could come and swim at the beach club.
Well, he was dead. Oh, your grandfather. No, your grandfather was not dead. My grandfather.
I understand. So, okay, now I'm confused because I thought Albert Fendig, your dad, was not Jewish.
He wasn't, but his father had been the one that converted.
His father was Jewish.
Yes.
So, and I have a Jewish friend, Ari, and when I tell him this, he just rolls his eyes because he's like, no, you're not in the club. You don't get to be Jewish.
You're not, because your mother is not Jewish.
Crap.
Sorry. And you can't, that means you cannot own property in Israel, nor can I.
It's a bunch of shit.
Well, and it's really a shame, but it's the way it is. There's only one of us who could, and that would be my father's sister's son.
Hold on one second. I'm going to make sure that this is recording. So, you've given birth to me.
Yes.
And then, so what happens after that? Where were we staying at the time?
You mean, where did we go home to?
Yes.
We were on St. Simon's Island, and we went home there the next day, and you had your bedroom across from our bedroom. Jeff's bedroom was down the hall.
Yes.
And I proceeded to nurse you.
Right.
Because you were hungry. You were a little teeny guy. You were 5 pounds, 19 ounces.
Premature.
5 weeks premature. But perfectly fine. I mean, there was nothing wrong with your lungs or anything. Now, you know, if a child's born that early, they'll put the child in neonatal in the intensive care units and things like that. But you were fine. So your brother walked into the room, saw me nursing you, and screamed down the hall to his daddy that baby was eating mama up.
I forgot that story. Kind of true.
Yeah, well, that's what Jeff thought.
So Jeff just sees this emaciated demon sucking on his mom's boobs, and he's probably traumatized about that ever since.
Well, he probably is still traumatized by it, come to think of it. Because, I mean, this baby moved into his home.
Now, before you retired, you were a psychologist for many, many, many years.
Right.
How much do you think that kind of thing has an impact on a person's personality?
An unbelievable amount. I would say that of all the people that I've seen over the years, anybody that was an older child had issues with the younger, the next youngest sibling, and particularly those who were like 18 months apart in age, that there is something that happens for that first born child that changes them forever with that.
Because it's suddenly you just have to share resources.
Well, suddenly you are called big when you're actually little. And so it's a, you know, it's a mind fuck right then and there.
Right.
And they have to, I mean, an 18-month-old is in no way big. They're still in diapers and they're still babies. And all of a sudden they're really required to be something that they aren't. And it changes them forever.
Be a big boy.
A big boy or a big girl. Be unselfish. Help mommy with this baby. Don't ask for anything. Don't wake the baby up. Try to be something that you aren't. And it it changes people forever.
So that you subscribe to the idea that the formative years create the beginning of a pattern that goes throughout your life.
Yes. I would say that the first 5 years of our lives shapes the personality structure in such a way that any kind of spiritual work that you're going to do later is going to involve looking back at the patterns that were set down in your family of origin.
There's no way to avoid that.
No. No way.
Because it seems like there's different schools of thought on that. There's some schools of thought that say, go back, dig through the past, put it in some kind of organized form to help explain the current turbulence you're experiencing, which is Western psychology, Freudian psychology especially. And then there's other schools of thought which say that's all gone. That's completely gone. And instead of going back to try to deal with where the patterns that you are going by came from, just deal with the patterns now.
Well, you start with what's going on right now. But if you start with what's going on right now, it's helpful to be able to realize that these beliefs or these patterns or these ideas or these ways of being in the world started when you were really little. Because think about it. I mean, anything that you were reinforced for in a positive way, you're going to lock in as the way a person should be. So if people thought you were especially wonderful if you brought mommy the diaper for the new baby, then that's going to tend to make you more responsible, maybe more responsible than you ever tended to be, maybe super responsible or maybe compulsively responsible.
Right.
So you start with where you are, but if you don't go back and see what's real and what's not real, then you're missing your way into reality, which is what spirituality is all about, as far as I'm concerned. It's distinguishing what's real from what's not real.
So the idea is go back and see. It's like nature teaches you a dance when you're a kid. And then that dance you continue throughout your whole life, even though the music is completely different when you get older. So you're doing some kind of dance based on something you learned when there was music playing, and now the music is gone from a waltz to some techno, and you have to learn a new way to dance. And so to learn that new way, you want to learn why you're dancing the way you are.
Well, you may call it a new dance, but it's the same old dance until you make it conscious and work with it. You're just dancing the same old dance.
Is this sort of the Gurdjieff idea that we're just automatons or robots until we start serious work on ourselves? We're just going
asleep.
And you believe that?
Gurdjieff's idea would be that, yes, I would say that if you you can call it being asleep, but you could also call it being in a trance, or you could call it being, sort of habitual or automatic.
Is that what you would call it, being in a trance?
Well, it's kind of like that because you're not really aware, you're not self-aware enough, or any of us, none of us is self-aware enough to realize that we're doing this. We just think this is the way to be.
Is this kind of work you're talking about, is this work that you can do by yourself solo, or do you have to have someone there with you to help you come out of the trance state?
I really think you need somebody with you, at least for certain phases of the work. Well, not constantly, but for certain phases of the work, you need somebody to mirror what's true and what's not true.
And can this just be friends? Or do you need a teacher?
Probably not. I would say you need a teacher. See, I have certainly needed a teacher.
This has always been one of the most frustrating aspects of spiritual work that they talk about, is this, again and again, you hear again and again, this necessity to find a teacher. And that opens up so much opportunity for exploitation to happen that it's, and also it requires leaving the house, which kind of sucks. It sucks to have to go and find a spiritual community, because I love to practice by myself. I love to meditate by myself, and I feel like I have a community online of people that I talk to, but every single thing I've read, from Gurdjieff to Ram Dass to any of the great Zen teachers, the thing that they all have in common is they had a teacher.
Right, because wisdom has been part of the human condition since the beginning of time, but wisdom is transmitted from teachers. And we need teachers in order to give us the wisdom, to disseminate the wisdom, and then it's our job to integrate it into our own consciousness. So that's why I'm saying teachers are needed for certain phases of the work, but then a lot of the work has to do with metabolizing it and letting it become part of who we are.
So it seems like a bit of luck to find a good teacher. I mean, if you can't just go hunting a spiritual teacher. If you do that, you end up at sitting around a crystal with somebody spraying lavender in your eyes and picking your pocket.
Right. I think it takes a lot of discrimination to find a reputable school.
Right. And then that's in a reputable school, the most reputable schools, they're not announcing themselves generally, are they? They don't advertise.
They don't advertise. No. But you will find yourself drawn to, if you're fortunate, you'll find yourself drawn to particular paths or particular ways of transmitting wisdom. And if you seek out that which you're drawn to, there's kind of an enlightenment drive in all of us, but it's hidden. A lot of people don't realize they have that, and it's hidden. So if you know that it's in you, that it's sort of a universal drive, and you realize that, then you'll begin to look to see what attracts you.
Right.
You know, sort of a magnetic attraction.
And that drive is different for everybody.
The level of drive is different, but the fact that it exists, right, is just like instinctual drives exist.
Well, I'm sorry. The thing that you're attracted to as far as spiritual schools go is different for everybody, of course. People have different compulsions. Like, not everybody wants to become Christian or Islamic, or not everyone wants to become a Rosicrucian, or not everyone wants to become a Hare Krishna. What I'm saying is there seems to be a unique karmic compass inside everybody that brings you in the direction of whatever school you happen to fall into.
I think that's an interesting question. And I would say that underlying attraction is not usually noticed, because most people have to realize that they're either going in the direction that their families taught them, or they're rebelling against it.
Right.
And so this attraction, this deeper attraction, would be underneath that tendency to comply or rebel against.
That tendency is what is the recipe for being a robot, is
either one of those. The rebellion is as much of a robotic kind of mechanism as the compulsion to conform.
This is the conundrum, isn't it? Because you come to this space of thinking where you begin to entertain the idea that pretty much everything you're doing is some kind of hypnotic, automated series of actions that originate from a time when you were completely unconscious. You had no self-awareness at all. And then, so you get to this place of thinking and you're like, well, okay, if I'm either reacting or complying and I'm an automaton, then how do I get off the train track, so to speak? You're on some tracks where the predetermined future, mm-hmm, that is a trajectory that can be traced back to the momentum of your past.
Right.
And so if you're on these tracks, even trying to get off the tracks is still going to just keep you on the tracks, even though you think you've gotten off of them. If you're still using a broken machine cannot fix itself.
Right. And that's why a teacher is needed. And the teacher needs to be devoted to truth.
How many people are out there devoted to truth?
There are people.
Well, you know, I have run into these people. You know, this is what you're talking about. It's really curious. There's different schools of thought in this regard. And one school of thought is the traditional idea of what's called disciplic succession. You've heard that idea before, mm-hmm, right? What the truth gets kind of, it's like the Olympic torch,
right,
gets passed down from some enlightened being,
right,
from one to the next to the next.
Without effort? Is that part of the story, that it is transmitted without effort on the student's part?
No, I think that there's a, I don't know if effort's the right word for it, but there is a, you do have to decide to change. Otherwise, there'd be no freedom there. You could just get in the presence of someone who had some information, and suddenly you shift.
Because I think there are people that want to ride somebody else's coattails to God, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, I mean, hell yeah. You don't want to do anything. It's like you just want someone to wave a wand in front of you and suddenly you have merged into everything. But see, this is an existential point, and it's a point that I struggle with all the time, which is the best summation of it that I've ever read was in the Brothers Karamazov, and it's Paul is on the road to Damascus. Saul of Tarsus is on the road to Damascus, mm-hmm, according to the Bible. And for those of you who don't love the Lord Jesus Christ, as me and my mommy do, Saul was persecuting Christians, and he liked to throw rocks at them, and he liked to rob them and beat them, which was a popular sport back then. And based on some Christians that I've run into, you can understand why that would be a popular sport. Not all of them, but some of them are dicks. So he's walking down this road, I guess, after just freshly beating a Christian with that kind of post-Christian beating glow that you get after you've given a Christian a nice flogging. And he's walking down the street or this path, and Jesus floats down from the sky. And, or I don't know if he floats down or appears out of a portal or how he jumps out of a bush, but suddenly Jesus is in front of Saul, this persecuting bastard. And he says to him, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? And in that moment, there's a conversion experience. Saul goes blind. His name gets turned into Paul, and he becomes the author of the epistles and pretty much what we've based modern day Christianity on. A guy who had just finished beating up a Christian hallucinated seeing Jesus on a dirt road.
Right.
Now, Dostoevsky analyzes that interaction. And his big question is, at that moment, was there a magical conversion that happened by being in the presence of the divine? And it just made him change. In the same way, if I drop ink in water, it's going to turn whatever the color of the ink was. Or at that moment, did Saul, a free person, realize this is a great chance for me to decide to be a better person? If there's ever been a time for me to like have an excuse to be a better person, this is it. I've got a great story. I hallucinated Jesus. You know, it's not going to get better than this. You know what? I don't really like beating Christians. It's not that fun. I'm going to be a better person. And this is a kind of like this is where I've kind of orbit around this story all the time, because I think when Ram Dass goes into the mountains and meets Neem Karoli Baba, and Neem Karoli Baba has some telepathy and is able to tell him what he was thinking the night before, and Neem Karoli Baba is just this man in a blanket, kind of the perfect costume. You're in India. There's this glowing man in the best costume ever. He's just wearing a blanket. He's surrounded by people who clearly adore him. What a great chance to be like, this is it. This is it. This is where I decide to be enlightened. This is the moment where I decide to be Ram Dass. This is the moment where I decide to be enlightened. Because if it's any other thing, then we're talking about drug dealers. Then we're talking about a pill. Here, eat this. You'll get better. I'm going to give you this pill. And this is the big question. You know, because if the answer is it's a pill, then you do need to go out there and find a teacher. And you do need to find Neem Karoli Baba. You do need to go out there and find somebody. But if the answer is it's just a reason, it's a reason, not a pill. It's like, look how happy this motherfucker is. Look how happy this man is. You could, if he's that happy, I could be that happy. It's a realization, not a, you know what I mean? Not, it's a realization, not a transmission. Do you know what I'm saying?
I kind of know what you're saying, but it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Although I think that there are people who obviously have had that kind of transformation, but I think it's an unusual experience. I don't think that it's a common way for people to mature and develop.
Well, it's not common.
And really, you know, and here is the distinction that I'm making, that for anybody that I've ever known, there is a process of development and maturation that needs to happen regardless. And I don't know if Paul had that development and maturation. We can hope he did. And perhaps he did, and I think he did. Some of his writings indicate that he did mature and develop. But that's a crucial component in spiritual work, and you'll find that there are spiritual masters or people perhaps who have received transmissions who have not done the maturation and the development that needed to happen, and they end up getting bitten in the ass.
No, they generally end up biting people in the ass, I think is more the way it turns out. They just end up with a bunch of cars. But again, you know, this is the thing. If you create a model in your mind of how it's going to be, you already have a model in your mind of how it's going to be. Everyone has some fantasy of the guru. Everyone has some fantasy of the saint or of the teacher. You already have an automatic idea of what it looks like in your head. The idea comes from movies or books you've read. It comes from who knows what. But in the process of being this sort of lumbering spiritual machine, you've constructed an idea of your mind in your mind of this is what the thing's going to look like.
But that would be the Buddha you would need to kill if you saw him on the road.
Yes, that's it. That's it. See, and so this is what, again, where we get in the perplexing predicament, where if you do start opening your mind to the idea that you are in a state of a sort of capitalist, modern day stupor, and you want out of the stupor, in your mind, you've already constructed an idea of what that's going to look like. And everyone, it's different for everybody.
And that's why you need a teacher, because the idea in your mind is going to be a barrier between you and actual realization.
But maybe before you get the teacher, you've got to get rid of that idea.
No, I don't think so. I think that it's only in seeing what's true in your idea and what's false in your idea that the idea will transform or transfigure. You will transform and you will transfigure because the false will dissolve and the true will grow. And that's how it works.
And this is the thing about teachers. And this is why I was just listening to some lecture by Ram Dass, and he was talking about self-destructing traps. He said, you know, true schools or true paths self-destruct, which is that once you get into it, you eventually will understand that you don't need it anymore. You'll realize the thing is not what you thought. And so many people, that's a shocking moment for so many people because they're like, I walked in on Baba Lulalo mouth fucking Latina. You know what I mean? And suddenly they're like, oh, he was a liar. He was was a fraud, a false prophet. Oh, and everything then is wrong. Everything that they taught then becomes soured and wrong. Even though they may have had real information that you can apply to your life. And so the reason, though I do love the idea of a teacher, and I would love nothing more than to be hiking in the woods and stumble upon a fellow in a robe who is like, tells me every single thing that I looked at on the internet that day or whatever, you know, like, that's a stupid example, but I'm just trying to think what's in my mind. Like, you know, who's able to analyze my mind and be like, Duncan, I know you. I've known you since the beginning of time. I love you. I'm going to show you the way. I love that idea. However that works out, whatever the thing is, at the grocery store, a mason comes up and gives you a tap on the shoulder, whatever the thing is, I love that idea. But I think that that is not how it works. I think that really the new version of the Christ consciousness, the new version of the teacher, the great universal truth, is a multifaceted being that is comprised of any tidbit of information that you can gather from the swirling variables surrounding you, and that those kind of things will eventually form together in a, you won't know what this reference is, like a Voltron, and become a being that teaches you in that way. Because I think the next great teacher is going to be a, I think it's highly likely that the next great teacher is going to be a computer. I think the next great teacher is going to be some kind of intelligence that wakes up from the machines. And that if people have already constructed in their mind that a teacher's got to be a fat dude in a robe, or a guy who's the crazy Arabian name, or a guy who's got a really serious gaze, or a guy who walks in a certain way, or a guy who only eats hummus and fish eggs and lives on a mountain. You know what I mean? I like the idea. Because here's the problem, man. Once you recognize that people are looking for a thing, it's really easy to think about what that thing is that the people are looking for.
But wait just one minute here.
Slap on a robe, shave your head, call yourself Daryl DeLooney, and that you're from the Pleiades system, and you will have 35 middle-aged women surrounding you, making you cupcakes and writing checks for you.
Oh, that may be true, but that would not be my definition of a teacher, nor the purpose of a teacher. That would be something else. That's not a teacher.
Right.
I think we need to define what we mean by teacher. At least I need to define what I mean by teacher. When I say a teacher is necessary at certain junctures on the path.
Yes.
I don't mean anything like that. Because one of the things that a teacher can teach you or teach me is how I tend to set up idealizations or ideas or weird ideas about what object will exist on the other side of the mountain or right, up there in heaven or out there somewhere.
Yeah.
And it isn't about that. That's not where you're going to find anything. You are not going to find anything in that teacher that is going to transmit the God seed into you, and right, you're not going to be a virgin who subsequently will give birth to the Christ. Not right, like that. That's not how it happens. At least I've never seen it happen that way. Maybe Paul, you know, had that experience. I don't know. I just don't know. I can't really speak about that. But I can say that what a teacher helps you do is just sort through pieces of shit to find anything that is nurturing there or nourishing, valuable, and to save those and flush the rest. That's really what a teacher does.
And so in that way, your career has been that of a teacher.
Definitely more of a teacher. The word therapist kind of makes me choke a little bit.
You know, this is the thing. We get into these words, you know, therapist makes you choke. Also teacher, if you're, many of us, when they hear the word teacher, we don't think about some sweet woman who's going to help you.
Suggesting that my teacher is a sweet woman.
I'm talking about you.
Oh.
We don't, what we think about is what we think.
I wouldn't think that any of my students have ever thought I was a sweet woman.
You are sweet. What we think about.
I'm your mama.
But we think of, you are. But what we think about when we think of teacher is what I think about. I think about the lady who taught me algebra. at West Henderson High School. She was morbidly obese, and like during class, once she started talking about how there was actually a talking snake in the Garden of Eden. Like, she's supposed to be teaching us algebra, and she's like, really, like, the thing spoke. It talked. Because someone's like, how do you really believe that there was a snake there? That thing spoke. And me, people are like, how would it talk? How would it sound? Look at its mouth. Like, it doesn't have the right tongue to speak. But she really believed it. So my point is, that's our problem, is that many of us have been imprinted with the idea that teachers suck.
Right. So you have a reification about the word teacher.
Well, not just me. I don't.
I'm saying you, as in you and the people who will be listening to this.
Maybe not all of us. But therapist. When you hear that. Therapist, you think of somebody who's gonna. When I think of therapist, I think of someone just from TV, as many of us have been conditioned, someone in a suit and a tie with glasses who kind of looks down his nose right. at you and listens to you and doesn't say much and write right. things on a pad.
There are people who do that for right. sure. And those are just, you're right. Those are really important things to realize, that those stereotypic ideas exist. But in terms of spiritual work, which, I mean, we need to maybe define what that means, too.
Define it.
Well, what it means for me is that the recognition that I have been living under a delusion for all these years, and that there is an alternative way to see reality rather than through veils of delusion or illusory kinds of beliefs. That there are ways to see what's real that have to do with my own consciousness. So my consciousness may be all kinked up and distorted, and when I can see things more clearly, it relaxes and unkinks, and I'm able to be freer and more spacious and more open, and life becomes easier and less of a struggle.
See where I get it from, people? I grew up with this. That's awesome. It's really cool. Now, the question is, just a lot of people, like I think about when I've been in very confused, turbulent times where I haven't wanted to be who I am and have immensely disliked myself. And I use that as a reference point. Tangled mess of poverty and debt and confusion and like bad relationships and just general chaos. Kind of like when you're going down a river and you don't know how to canoe and you end up stuck on the side of the river in a bunch of branches covered in mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. So many people, that's where they're at right now. They're just the canoe,
almost everyone is.
The rudder was messed up and they end up on the side of the river. Then they blame themselves for that and they hate themselves there on the side of the river. Or they try to pretend that the side of the river is where you need to be. And there's some romance and getting gnawed on by weasels and bees. How do you get someone from the side of, if someone like that was listening right now, mm-hmm. and they're hearing you talk about a teacher or this or that, and they're like, I don't have enough money to buy a sandwich to eat today. Mm-hmm. What do they do? What's some steps that they could take to begin this process of coming to truth?
I think the easiest thing for that person to do is to get present. And that means to put the past aside, put the future aside, and sense into their bodies. They can do that even if they don't have a penny. They can sense into their bodies and sense on the inside. There's an entirely different sensation than there is by just touching ourselves on the outside. That inside, if we can learn to perceive and sense ourselves from the inside, our state of consciousness changes.
Can you walk me through what that might be like? What a meditation would be like?
Can you sense the inside of your hand right now?
Hold on. Like under my skin?
Yeah, like inside your hand.
Yeah.
You can sense it from the inside.
I can, I mean, I don't know if I'm projecting that feeling, but I can feel a certain.
What does it feel like?
kind of like a, like when you push magnets against each other or something, kind of like a, kind of like there's a nail going through it.
Really?
And I'm on a cross.
Like, okay,
I am
no,
Jesus.
No,
I'm just
no.
kidding. No, I'm totally kidding. Can I feel inside my hand? I've never tried to do this.
Okay, well, we're going to try it right now. Okay, so sense your hand, sense your index finger from the inside. Index, that's pinky.
Oh. Okay. Yeah, it's kind of warm.
Yeah. Warm and what else?
Numb. I don't know. Warm and numb.
Numb?
I don't know. Numb is the right word. It just feels like an energy, you know?
Yeah, you're right. So see if you can sense your whole hand from the inside. That same way. Take your time. If you've never done this before, it's hard.
Yeah, I can feel something in there. Like,
all right. You do? Okay. Let it just gently let your attention go up your arm.
Yeah.
See if you can sense your whole arm from the inside.
Yeah, it feels like there's wolves running in my arm.
Oh, that's not. See if you can sense both of your arms at the same time from the inside.
Yeah, I could do that.
And if you can do that, add your legs so that you can sense your arms and your legs at the same time from the inside.
Yeah, it's weird. Yeah, I could do that.
That is presence.
That's weird. I've never done that before. That's weird.
That's presence. And what you're doing is you're not in your mind. This gets you out of your mind. You are not mediating your sense of your arms and legs through your mind. Through your mind, mental.
Right. So that's a way to get you out of your head.
That's what you can do immediately when you're on the side of the river being nibbled by weasels and bees.
Right. So.
And so the next thing you can do, Duncan.
Yes.
Is while you are sensing your arms and your legs simultaneously.
Yes.
Add two more facets. Look. Sense your arms and legs and look.
Look at what?
Whatever you see. Just let it come to you. Don't search it out.
Okay.
Just take in what you see.
It's a bee with 1,000 eyes and horns. It's holding a dagger covered in pentagrams.
If you're on the side of the river, then what else could it be?
You know,
wait a minute. There's one more piece.
Go ahead.
And listen. So you sense your arms and legs. You look and you listen. All at the same time. Three things you're doing.
Yeah, I get it. It gives you a kind of clarity.
It gives you clarity and it takes you into a slightly different dimension of consciousness.
Right. Right.
It's quite different, actually. It is a quite different.
And because I've got a microphone in front of my face and it's a podcast, it's hard for me to do what I would like if I was really sitting by myself. But I think that this recipe for a meditative exercise is awesome.
Well, what it does is allows you to get into presence without a teacher and without a penny to your name.
Yes.
And even as you are in that state of presence, if you are in it, even for a minute, if you can stay in it for a minute, you will begin to sense the flow of energy. You will sense that there is a river because a lot of people on the side of the river don't even realize there's a river.
Right.
So.
What's the river?
It's reality with its flowing dynamism. I mean, if you look out there at the world, you'll see that it's constantly changing and transforming all the time. Well, the same thing is true inside of us.
Right.
And that there's a flow to it. You can sense a flow to it. But you can't unless you're in presence. Because if you're in your mental thinking mind, it's your ordinary mind and you won't be able to do it.
Right.
So it's just really easy. You can move back and forth between these dimensions of ordinary consciousness and something that is out of space and time.
Right. And that thing outside of space and time is...
is more real than the mental constructs.
That's just your true identity.
What we've just been talking about, yeah. Because all of that is just stuff that you've learned throughout your life because of the family you were born in and the situations you had, circumstances you were in, and your natural proclivities.
That is some potent stuff. Really cool.
Free of charge. You can do it. No teacher needed.
And then from that, that'll probably lead you in the direction eventually that you would need to go in.
Well, what's interesting to do is from that place, if you can learn to stay in that place and sustain it for a minute, say for a minute.
Yes.
Then you will find yourself with questions that come up, like just naturally arising questions, not right. questions that you read in a book. Just, I wonder something. I wonder how come blah, blah, blah. And so you can have an inquiry, sort of an open-ended inquiry into your experience. And so what I was just teaching you has to do with direct knowing. And direct knowing is very different from knowing cognitively.
Right.
Direct knowing is genuine knowing.
Right.
It is indisputable. What you directly know cannot be disputed.
Give an example of something you directly know.
The sensation inside your body.
Right.
And then you can know whether or not there are tensions in your body.
Right.
You can know what's going on, what you're feeling emotionally. You can know what sort of preoccupations you might be having mentally.
And then the question is, why am I feeling like that? Why do I have this preoccupation? Is that what you mean by inquiry?
You could wonder about that. You could wonder about that. And generally speaking, the very first thing that is going to come up is a judgment about it.
Yeah, what's wrong? Am I crazy?
Yep. So the first thing that you're going to contend with is this, I hate to say it, but like your inner mother.
Yeah.
Is going to come in and say, you know what? I think you're wasting your time, Duncan. Why don't you get up and do something productive?
Right.
Or this is really dumb. Or whatever. So the first thing you have to deal with is the fact that if you have a lot of judgment going on, it's going to stop your inquiry.
Right.
That's where teachers become helpful because they can say, you know what, I think that sounds pretty judgmental.
Right.
And you might not even notice it because you may be constantly judgmental inside yourself.
And the judgment is just a way to sort of thwart this progression.
Well, it does thwart.
It's a defense mechanism.
It's what you learned before you were 7 years old about how to get along in the world without, it's guidance. It's a teacher. It's an inner teacher. But it's harsh, critical, and will be a barrier to your expansion and your maturation, your development.
Right.
Because it will hold you. Its job is to keep you in your ego identity.
Right.
That's its total job.
So basically what you're talking about is, reminds me of the idea of, you know, being in a, before you can escape from a prison, you need to know the layout of the prison. And
yes.
Then once you know the layout of the prison, then you can start planning your escape route.
Exactly. And, you know, there was some kind of Sufi story about a guy who was in prison. And there was an oriental rug in his prison cell. And he looked at that long enough and he could see the... just by looking inside the cell, which would be looking inside your body, you are going to find the key that will release you. That's where you have to look.
Right.
It's in the patterns inside that oriental rug,
right.
So in your cell or inside whatever it is, whatever configurations in your consciousness.
And so this inquiry that you're talking about is kind of the beginning of getting a visual of what that rug is.
Yes. Yeah, you have to be able to see the barriers. You've got to be able to see the locks.
Right.
Before you can open anything.
Right.
You've got to see what is keeping you from opening the door.
You know, this has not occurred to me before because I guess I don't really care. Like, but I'll sometimes when you talk about like this sort of things with comedians, they right away will say, I do not want to get enlightened because I'll stop being funny. Mm-hmm. Which is a very funny thing for anyone to say, because it's like me saying, like, when I work out, like, sometimes you'll hear people when they start working out, just like, I don't want to get too muscular.
Right.
It's like, you're in no danger, friend. You know what I mean? Like, like, you're not just going to work out and suddenly, like, pump up. But in the same way, some people, it's a curious thing where people, when they begin to spiral around what you're talking about here, which is this idea of like, hey, listen, you might just be in a tiny little room of a beautiful mansion, and you've decided that that room that you're in is your house. But when people start hearing that, I'm like, fuck that, man. The rest of the mansion's haunted. I'm not interested in going out of this room.
But that's the judgment. That's the judge. Right. That's the very first thing you're going to find. If you begin to do this, I guarantee you, the first thing you're going to find is something that is going to say, this is a really bad idea. Go back to being who you really are. Which is your old ego self.
A dick.
You know, it's perhaps a dick, but on the other hand, it could be a baby sucking tit.
I don't think so. I think most people, it's more like, a baby sucking on a boob is a sweet thing, but many people are so, you know, I see it as a kind of, like, you get around a dog that's been beaten.
Yeah.
I've seen video of dogs that have been beaten and someone's giving them meat. And as they're handing the dog food, all the way up to giving the dog food, the dog's pissed, growling. But you can see that the dog just can't control the thing. It's like, you know, do you ever get muscle cramps in your feet?
Mm-hmm.
Is that something in our family?
I don't mean to go into that. No, I don't think really so.
But when you get a muscle cramp,
yeah,
you know, it reminds me of that too, which is that, there's people whose personalities have cramped up and become a growling, snarling dog, and anything that you bring to it, it's going to growl and snarl. And that's why I say a dick.
Okay. But I could say that is a perfect example of what I'm talking about with the tit imagery, the sucking the tit.
Yeah.
Because if you have been around tit suckers,
my whole life,
if you have been around a real live tit sucker, which means a baby.
Are you talking about a baby? Let's call them babies.
Okay, we'll call this a baby.
So that'd be awesome if people call babies tit suckers.
Well, this baby, okay, so there are babies that get so frustrated because their mother does not come and deliver the tit when the baby wants it, that the baby screams and screams and screams.
Yes.
And by the time the mother comes, the baby is so frustrated, he'll bite her tit. That's
really?
Like the dog in the meat. Yes. He'll reject her, even though he's starving.
Right.
And then what happens when mom's tit gets bitten?
Blood.
Blood. And you know what? She's going to get really pissed at the baby.
Right.
And she's going to say, you know, I have other things to do than get bitten.
Stuff.
So this hungry baby is going to lose his opportunity to have a tit.
So this is what you're talking about is the way so many people are reacting to the world, which is that they are so upset that they haven't received the thing that they wanted. And then when the thing finally does come, they try to punish everyone around them with the thing that they got.
Exactly.
Right. And that drives it away because you're that's brilliant. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I know many a soul like that.
Yes.
And that is a sad state to be in. I get it now. Okay, that's really cool. So you're in this constant pattern of screaming. The thing finally comes. By the time it comes, you're so hungry, you're pissed. You drive the thing away, and then the pattern repeats forever.
Yes.
And that's how you end up in the side of the river with weasels chewing on your neck and bees and leeches.
You can also have this longing for the perfect tit.
Yes.
You know, so you can say, mom might come. And, or she might be on the other side of the room, and you just know how utterly delicious it would be to actually get mom to come over on this side of the room where you are, and you just long and you long.
This is getting weird. This is something that you could talk about.
It's another client.
But using the metaphor or analogy of tit sucking with your kid but I do know what you're saying. I mean, it's the first source. You're talking about the first source of sustenance.
Yes, I am. The source. You're exactly right. This is the source.
This is the first food you get comes out of a boob.
Exactly. And it is so profoundly important.
Milk volcano.
What?
Milk volcano?
Milk volcano. Yeah, sure. But, I mean, it's so important that we get confused and we think that the source, you know, we maybe have similar reactions to anything that we might call the source.
Right. Right.
And so rejection, hope, and desire are all built into this.
Right. Yes, yes. It makes sense. It really makes great sense. It's a great way to put it. It really is. And that kind of loosening up in relation to right. I get what you're saying. Because the idea is like if you are in a state, a poverty state.
Right.
There's a certain amount that you can control. Right. In any poverty state, there's a certain amount you can control. Some stuff you might not be able to control. When the tornado comes whipping through your neighborhood and your house gets blown down and somehow you didn't have insurance and you lose everything, you can't control that. But you can certainly control how you're going to react to that situation.
If you can become aware of your reactivity, then you can respond to it more easily rather than just repeat the reactions.
Because the house is always going to get knocked down.
That's part of life. The house gets knocked down.
There's just no way out of that.
There is no way out of it.
But sometimes the house gets knocked down in a really extreme way.
Well, it's true. But if you will think about all the times that your houses have gotten knocked down in your life,
yes,
they are actually the transformative moments.
Right. Right. That kind of brings us to the idea to something that you have been dealing with for 4 years now, which is that you have stage 4 bone cancer.
Metastatic breast cancer.
Metastatic breast cancer. And this is an extreme, extreme version of a tornado knocking a house down. Because 4 years ago, you called to tell us that you had 6 months to live.
I have been told that at least a dozen times.
A dozen times that you've had 6 months to live.
I have been told to call a crematorium and find out how much it would cost to be cremated because I had maybe a month or 6 weeks and that I needed to know that so that I could pay the money up front before I died. And I have made the call to the crematorium and I found out that it was $750. Thank you very much.
Wow. God, that is so fucked. But I have, it seems like cancer is pretty popular these days. And I know, you know, many people are getting afflicted with cancer.
Right.
And I always like talk about you, your situation, because sitting across from you, you have a terminal prognosis, and you look better than before you had cancer. You look healthy. You're focused. You seem better. Now, what is that? How do you explain that under this burden? Because I can't, I mean, just knowing that you have this has been a darkening experience for me and has been its own incredible challenge for me to assimilate it and deal with it. It's been very hard, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But for you, how have you managed to transform something that when people hear that, they're like, fuck it, I'm going to start smoking, drinking, taking narcotics and just die. How have you been so courageous and what are you doing? What's your secret in all this?
Well, that's a really good question. And I have, first of all, I listened to the Western medical doctors with one eyebrow raised because these are the people that have told me that I was going to die right away. And I have looked for alternatives. I've looked to see what I have been eating that was incorrect and I've changed it. I've looked to see what emotional stressors were in my life and I've worked to lessen those. And I've looked at my environment, my physical surroundings, and I've done everything that I could do to enhance that. And I do intense spiritual work all the time. So ultimately, when you hear stage 4 cancer, the word death comes to mind.
Yes.
And it comes to mind for me too. And so one of the major things that I've done is inquire into what that word means to me and inquire into what kind of relationship I have with that idea and what it actually, how it impacts me to consider dying.
Right.
And to make peace with the fact that there are parts of that that I don't have any control over, and there are parts of it that I do have control over. In other words, the diet and the stress and those kinds of things, I can change and make more optimal. The possibility that there is some kind of force that will take us out when it's time to go out is nothing that I can do anything about.
Right.
So I may as well make peace with it.
Right.
It's easier to go with the flow of that particular river than it is to try to fight it. That there is that possibility. We're all going to die.
I know. And how much do you think, in relation to what we were talking about earlier, about how much when you were a child, the early experiences affect the rest of your life, how much do you think that realization that many people seem to be trying to hide from, that we are all going to die, how much does that impact people's behavior and actions?
Well, I think that my own relationship to death and dying that I have come to at this point in my life has nothing to do with anything I learned from my family of origin.
Right.
Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
And this is that saying, and I don't know where it comes from, but that meditation is preparation for death.
I think that's true. And meditation is one spiritual practice that prepares us for death. But also, you know, if you look at the world, what you see is things appearing and disappearing. And humans are a part of the whole of that. And humans appear and they disappear off the face of the earth. That just happens. You know, our egos personalize it, and we consider ourselves special cases.
Yes.
But we're really not. You know, we are part of the whole, and everything in the whole transforms all the time. Changes form, transfigures.
You're a special case.
It's because I'm your mama.
No. No, I know, but come on. There's no way to stop the heartbreak. What do you do about that?
You cry. You cry.
You're listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. It's located on the iTunes comedy section. Very funny podcast. It's really hard. But it's definitely something everyone's got to, you know, deal with.
Yeah.
And it's such a strange thing. I mean, the universe, it seems so stable. Mm-hmm. If you are, you know, in this kind of automatic state.
Mm-hmm.
And the encounter with truth, which for me, you're dying, this thing has been probably the greatest run-in with truth that I've had in my whole life. I mean, you can't really, it's inexpressible.
Yeah.
But it's not like it makes you feel, this is not a feeling of like, this is not a desirable feeling.
No.
But it's a feeling that every single human being will experience one way or the other.
It is.
But so many of us are spending so much time engaged in just ridiculous activities, it seems like, just to try to avoid this experience.
Exactly. People really try to avoid the consideration that they are going to die and the people they love are going to die.
But it seems like that oriental rug that we're talking about there, that is the key mm-hmm. to everything.
Yes.
As terrible a key as that is, it feels like once you realize that, it's so hard to be closed off. Why would you be like that?
Why would you close off? Yes. Right. So that is the key. That is the key because it opens your heart. It breaks your heart open.
Yes.
You know, our hearts have been closed because we've closed them. We've defended ourselves against pain. And This is the kind of things that opens them.
Opening your heart sucks. This hurts. The thing. Like, you know, this is the thing Ram Dass talks about all the time. It hurts. Does it always hurt? Does opening your heart always just hurt? Or are you just in a constant state of...
No, it doesn't always hurt. But when it really cracks open, it hurts. You know, and it does. But even the hurt transforms. Because if you inquire into the hurt, you know what you're experiencing is love.
Right.
The real deal.
Right. I can see that. Yeah, it's very, it's right. Because it's seeing newness. It's seeing how much you value life.
Yes. And the reason I look better now than I ever have is because I am more fully living.
Right.
Because I'm living and dying consciously. Simultaneously, I'm holding both.
What advice would you give to people out there who are dealing with this very thing?
I would tell them to cry when they need to cry and to turn toward this thing that's called death. Turn toward it. And even if you're afraid to turn toward it, turn toward it. It won't hurt you. And see what it has to teach you. It's a tremendous teacher, free of charge.
I don't think it'd be sell a lot of goddamn tickets if it was trying to. That's a show I'm gonna skip if I can. Wow.
But it's a teacher. I mean, we're talking about teachers. It's the real deal.
Yes.
And you know what I find is that the closer I get to physical death, the more alive I feel, and the more present I feel, and the more real I am. And I realize that I have no idea what lies on the other side of physical death, but that there is so much aliveness that's building in me that I can't help but think there is some connection between that and the movement toward physical death.
Yeah, well,
I can't explain that. I don't have an explanation for that.
Well, yeah, no, nobody knows. I, from my limited experience with it, I definitely, and from run-ins with people who seem to be quite advanced, It's more like a surprise party than it is a car accident, I think. But we can never know that.
We cannot know. And we can't know, you know, we can't know what our own death is going to be like. But I do think that we suffer more if we resist that flow of the river.
Right.
It's always flowing. That if we try to get over there to the side so that we can get on the bank and be exempt from the flow, that's where we begin to suffer
right.
more and more.
It's just letting go into that thing.
Yes. And the amazing thing about letting go into it is that you find that this thing called love is supportive, that it holds us. It has a quality of benevolence that we might have never noticed. And we ask, what's that? What is it that has a quality of benevolence? And the only word that I can come up with is reality. Reality actually has this quality of benevolence.
Yes. Right. Yes. And even benevolence is a very small word for what it is, isn't it?
Yes. Yes.
It's just like, it's just so intense. You know how people with autism have all these defensive reactions because they're experiencing so much more of the world?
Uh-huh.
I think that humans are autistic in their own way, in the sense that this experience of love energy is so powerful that to combat against it, we build an entire life, an entire ego to try to not feel it. Because
yes.
It's just so overwhelming.
It is. It's a killer. It's ego death.
Yeah. Not desirable.
It is desirable. And that's why it hurts. It's ego death. Your heart cracks open and your ego is dying.
Right.
But you find that ego death is a transfiguration. It's an alchemical transfiguration.
Yes. Because, yeah, who wants to carry around this fucking weight?
You don't. I don't.
Well, I love you very much, obviously.
I love you too. And Duncan, that kind of love isn't going anywhere. That's another thing you find, that I may leave this plane of existence sooner rather than later, but the love isn't going anywhere. I'm as certain of that as I am of anything.
Right. I believe you. Well, let's cut to a commercial. We are back with my sweet mom, and I'm going to ask her some questions that people have for her on Twitter. So let's just go through and see what people want to say. Yeah, that's a pretty good one. It's from JD at the Blackery. Do you think that being consciously open is passed through genes or culturally in the home solely?
I think that's an interesting question. And I was just thinking about that earlier today, because you and I are like-minded, and this did not come through the environment you were raised in. It's like there's something that we share that neither of us created.
Right. Well, there's your answer to that. Now, this is a very important question from Terry Osborne. At Terry Osborne 1984 wants to know, who's your favorite child?
You know I'm not going to answer that question. I don't want to be in trouble.
Well, that's a ridiculous question. There's no right answer. There's no answer to that, you asshole. That's a silly, silly question, you bastard. Here's one from Nick Goulart. Nick Goul, G-O-U-L-4-R-T, wants to know, can you remember any funny stories about baby Duncan, the little sweetie?
Yes.
All right, let's hear one.
One funny story. Oh, well, he had a speech impediment. And he, instead of saying sponge, he said funge. And so he also said Fundering Feodor.
Why did I say that?
Thundering Feodor. Maybe there was a cartoon or something about Thundering Feodor.
Yeah.
But it was Thundering Feodor. And you would talk about Thundering Feodor by while you were cleaning the table with a funge.
What an idiot. I sound like a real dope. All right. Let's see here. A lot of people want to know how you felt about me taking acid when I was in high school. I don't even know how much you knew I was doing that.
Well, that's the first thing I was going to say, is that I did not know you were taking acid until you were out of high school. So I was oblivious to it. It was happening under my roof. And I was a psychotherapist at that time and worked with people who were actually using LSD and worked with parents of children who were using LSD, and I was oblivious to the fact that you were using LSD.
Haha. See that, folks? I was smooth.
It was
smooth operator. Okay, let's keep moving here.
I just thought I had a weird son.
I'm going to ask one more question. This is from SMBECK99. Do you believe in aliens?
Well, what does that mean? What do aliens mean?
I don't know. Space creatures? Space beings?
I certainly don't think we're alone in this universe.
So you think it's...
I just don't think we're alone
right.
in this universe.
I agree with that. Me either. Well, thank you so much for
You're
giving
very
me
welcome. It is
existence
my pleasure.
And for being on my podcast, but my also pleasure. Thank you for allowing me to have a human incarnation. Do you have anything you want to say to people? Any last thing for this podcast you'd like to send out into the world?
I would just like to say that you're very fortunate to be in this kind of relationship with Duncan. He is one of the most interesting people that lives on this planet today. And I can tell you that with certainty.
Oh, you are too sweet. Truth? You're the most interesting person.
Truth is truth. Duncan, please. Truth is truth.
You are a wonderful mom, and I love you. And if you guys want to ask questions, polite questions to my mom, I started a Twitter account for her. It's at Duncan's Mom 108 at Twitter. If you guys want to tweet to her or follow her on Twitter, I don't know how much she's going to know how to use Twitter.
No, I've never used
it. Or what's going to happen, but if you feel like it, if you want to talk to her about this podcast, if you have any love energy that you want to throw her way, you can tweet to her. And also her Gmail that I set up for this podcast is duncansmom108@gmail.com. If you have any questions about what she was talking about, her teacher, this path that she's on, I'm sure she can point you in the right direction. So say hi. And thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Duncan.
Okay, this is Upward Over the Mountain by Iron and Wine. Great band from a great album, The Creek Drank the Cradle, on iTunes. So buy the album. See you guys later.